Stutter Talk would like to thank the good folks at the International Fluency Association for helping to make this episode possible. Visit them at theifa.org. Visit Stutter Talk at stuttertalk.com. Dr. Tom Vitish and Christopher Constantino begin this episode with their first daily wrap-up from day one of the International Fluency Association's 2015 World Congress on Cluttering, Stuttering, and Other Fluency Disorders in Lisbon, Portugal. The episode ends with Chris interviewing Ineka Sampson, a speech-language pathologist in Stockholm, Sweden, about her poster session titled Stuttering from a Gender Perspective. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to Stutter Talk.
And welcome to the World Congress of the International Fluency Association.
We are here in Lisbon, the beautiful southern European capital of Portugal.
And my name is Chris Constantino.
And my name is Tom Weidig.
And we are going to do our daily wrap-up of the conference.
Great. So let's start. We will first talk about the keynote speech. Could you just tell us a bit what it was about?
Yeah. So the keynote speech was by David Ward and Kate Watkins, and they were giving it. It began as an introduction to neuroimaging techniques and how they've been used in the past with investigating fluency disorders. And then as the talk went on, they discussed their own research about how they were using neuroimaging techniques. They specifically used fMRI to investigate cluttering and stuttering. And this was a fairly novel study. Cluttering has not been very well researched, especially in neuroimaging studies. So it was a very welcome research project, and hopefully when they, as they start to analyze more of their data, we'll see a lot more studies of that kind coming in the future.
I was asking a question to Kate Watkins, and that was on subtypes, because Kate Watkins was showing us a lot of the common findings from her brain imaging studies. But what I've always been puzzled about was how about subtypes? I mean, she didn't mention it. And for me, there are like two things that are quite important. First, there is a genetic component to stuttering. And so you would expect that different gene mutations might cause different changes in the neurobiology. And second, if we look at brain injury studies of people who have a neurogenetic stuttering, I mean, there it seems to be that quite a few brain areas can be affected that actually leads to stuttering.
Yeah, and one of the interesting findings I think that they had, this doesn't really answer the subtype question, especially because they didn't really look at subtypes, but in a lot of the stuttering research that you see, people who stutter tend to activate their speech and language centers differently than people who are fluent. Different areas activate, and different ordering of the activations you tend to see. Whereas in cluttering, at least in this one study, they didn't find different areas or different orders of activation. It was more overactivation. Yeah.
I would say the one problem is also it was just like one study, and as far as I understood, it was like six people that were involved in the study.
I think there was 17.
Oh, 17.
Six of them were pure
Clutterers.
Clutterers. 11 of them were stutterers and clutterers. Then there was a separate stuttering group that was 17 people who stuttered, and a separate group that was 17 people who were fluent.
It was actually quite interesting because Katrin Neumann, who is a professor of neuroscience in Germany from the University of Bochum, but she actually also asked a question or made the feedback, and she said that she also did the study and she found different areas.
Yes.
So it's kind of a bit. So it's always a bit like.
Are you referring to the woman who raised her hand?
Yeah.
What was so interesting about her was she found the same areas but the opposite activation pattern, right?
Yeah.
She was saying, whereas this current study by Ward and Watkins found overactivation in all the normal speaking areas, she found underactivation in all the normal speaking areas. And I think your question about subtypes sort of ties into that, right? Because what if you're looking at different types of cluttering or different types of stuttering?
Yeah, I think one issue that I find when Kate Watkins actually said, look, we have identified a common area in all the different researches, then I'm just wondering, okay, but if there are subtypes, then they just found the common area, and maybe those common areas are really maybe more just consequences of stuttering. That maybe what we have is in the brain a network of brain regions working in synchrony, and there may be in the different causal subtypes one of the brain regions or connections between the regions affected, and then maybe that then leads to some kind of impact on the whole system, and maybe that impact on the whole system is then what is actually common to all people who stutter, and then maybe they actually just located that region that kind of gets and a result of the work of that network. So
yeah, it's hard to tease that apart until you start doing a lot more childhood imaging studies where it's right around the onset of stuttering, right? Then maybe you can start to see whether something is an effect of stuttering and cluttering or a underlying cause.
Yeah, I agree. One thing that would also be actually an idea, and I was actually discussing that with Cato Watkins and Per Arm, was that ideally you would like to take just people who just have one specific gene mutation, because that is a very clean sample, because we know that then that gene mutation is affecting the brain in roughly the same way, and then you have one subtype in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
But that's probably for a future Stutter Talk a podcast in 50 years or something like that. Okay, so why did I don't we just move on to the next one? You have been to a session, parallel session. Maybe you can tell us quickly about that, what that was about.
Yeah, so how this conference it was set up was there was a couple streams of parallel sessions that were going on all at once. So as you mentioned, I went to parallel session number one. The first talk in that session was by Smits Banstra, and this was it was called Self-Help Groups Enhanced Student Learning and Fluency Disorders Courses. And this was a qualitative research study that looked at how immersing graduate students in self-help groups helps them to better understand working with people who stutter. And her data really pointed to that being beneficial. Yeah.
You see, I always ask myself an innocent question. I'm just saying, you see, why do you need to do research on this? Because it seems to me to be plainly obvious.
Yeah.
I mean, is it not? Yeah, I mean, if you have to treat patients, then isn't very useful to just know about their perspective? And I mean, do you really need to do research to do that?
I think
that would be my challenging question if I had been at that meeting. Obviously, everyone would have been shocked by that question. But
I agree with you that this seems like, of course, it's helpful for graduate students to attend these self-help meetings. But it's nice to be able to reference a citation that proves it, right? Like if you're writing an article, you want to be able to say,
"Oh no,"
without anybody challenging you, that this is beneficial, right?
Yes, so that's kind of always like, you always need a reference, if you have a reference, that's okay.
Yes. Okay. So there's your reference.
Okay, great.
Next talk was by Heather Grossman and Sarah McIntyre from the American Institute for Stuttering, and they basically talked about their the intervention program that they do at the American Institute for Stuttering, which is an intensive and extensive treatment center in New York City. And they basically outlined their whole approach to helping people with stuttering. And it was very interesting because there was a lot of talks that I went to today that were about certain therapy programs, which ties into the next talk by Langevin, Swift, and Lomheim from University of Alberta in Canada and the ISTAR program. Their talk was called Mindfulness Following the Comprehensive Stuttering Program. And it was interesting the differences between the two fluency or treatment programs that both the American Institute and ISTAR gave. They're both very different programs. American Institute for Stuttering was very against using any sort of what they called stuttering techniques or tools.
Okay.
Whereas ISTAR was very much for those things. Yeah.
So as a one, they wouldn't use tools like what, like a gentle onset or things like that, or like in syllabus talk more like that, or like gentle onset.
They felt that any sort of tool used in order to stop stuttering was almost an additional secondary behavior. It was an additional avoidance behavior that they felt was unproductive.
Because I also feel, I mean, I've been doing that in the past, and it sometimes leads to more unnatural speech, and that's why it's more difficult to actually incorporate it in your own way of speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Even so, I have to say that often people say, yes, it's slightly more unnatural gentle onset, but you just have to do it for a few months until you get into the rhythm, and then slowly you can reduce its intensity.
Yeah.
So maybe you start at the beginning, you say, I would, a bit more, and then you say, I would, mm-hmm. which is much more gentle.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think with all of those sort of techniques, they can start out sounding very unnatural, but the idea is over time they'll get more natural. I think at a deeper level, though, what Grossman and McIntyre were talking about was, what is the point of using them? Are you avoiding stuttering, or are you embracing stuttering? And I think they were trying to steer people away from any sort of avoidance behavior.
Okay, great. And now we come to the two best talks of the day. The first one, I believe, is by a certain Chris Constantino. I believe that you can tell us a bit more about what he talked about.
Yeah, I my talk was called Passing as Fluent, a Foucauldian Analysis, and Peter and I, for all the Stutter Talk listeners out there, Peter and I talked about my research a couple episodes ago, so I won't go too in-depth about it, but it was basically a study that I conducted that looked at how people who pass as fluent construct their identities, and using Michel Foucault's theories on ethics, And I think it was very, very well received by the audience, and it got a lot of positive feedback. So I was excited about all of that work. Yeah.
So did you get any questions or any feedback that you remember that might be worth talking about?
Yeah, so my study relies heavily on a social model of disability.
Okay.
And I had a lot of the audience members come up to me after the talk who expressed sort of a relief that people were finally talking about the social model, because a lot of them came from sociology or psychology and felt that speech language pathology has been slow to take up the social model, and that we've been so heavily dominated by the medical model. Not that they need to compete, but just it's nice to hear alternative voices in the field.
So I was I'm always puzzled with the social model, because is it that you just say, well, a stuttering is just another way of talking, it's not abnormal, it's okay, you can just stutter, everything is fine. It's a bit like stuttering pride in a sense. Is it really that, or is it more like you say, oh no, I acknowledge there is a dysfunction there, but still at the same time, it's not as bad, it's okay to do it? I mean,
the social model is a huge perspective, so yes. There will be different people with different opinions within that.
Okay.
And I think the traditional way of looking at it was to separate the idea of impairment from the idea of disability.
Okay.
Where impairment was the actual function and anatomy of one's body.
Okay.
The disability is an active process. So you're disabled by the way society reacts to an impairment or treats an impairment. Now, I think there are much more radical social theorists that would imply that even the impairment is always within a social context, and that can't be separated from.
Yes, because I'm kind of a bit of not the greatest fan of that kind of thing. But I think that's probably a topic for one single podcast, I would imagine.
So now let's go on to another wonderful talk by our favorite co-host. Can you give us the title of your talk?
Yeah, so basically, the title of our talk was a novel, a biopsychosocial model catering for the complexity of stuttering. So I've been working quite hard over the last 10 or 15 years to really understand stuttering, and I realized that there are biological factors to it, psychological, social factors, as we just discussed. And so I always felt that, but how can you actually merge all that information also with more hardcore scientific evidence, like genetics, abnormal neurobiology, and so on? And so I came up with quite a simple conceptual framework for stuttering that I call the neurological mental capacity model. And then I actually put that into a more general concept, where I have actually written a book that's just come out, which is called Taking a Snapshot of the Human System. And there I propose a simple model of the human system that encompasses all the different elements that actually impacts on human behavior. And basically, it's a four-domain model. One is the environment, the body, and then you have confined memories and communicable memories.
Wow. So it sounds like you try to cover all of your bases, huh?
Yeah, I tried to cover everything effectively. Yeah. But of course, in not so great details, obviously, because it's more an overarching conceptual framework.
Yeah, how is it received?
Well, I think I was quite happy because often at stuttering conferences, I'm stuttering severely. It is as if I have to prove that I'm really stuttering, that I have a right to be there. Mm-hmm. And so I just felt it went quite okay. I didn't feel too much tension. Although people were asking interesting questions. And I also sold 3 books.
Well, there you go. Congratulations.
Yeah. Okay, great.
While your talk was going on, I was at the acceptance and commitment therapy talk by the City Lit therapists, Chessman and Everett. And I won't talk about this talk right now because I'm going to be interviewing them for a separate talk in the future.
Okay.
So you can look forward to that talk in the next couple of days.
And I think the next talk that we have to talk mm-hmm. is probably at the bar downstairs.
Yes.
Okay, so we would like to thank our listeners to listen to us. Do you want to say something else, Chris? Or, yeah.
No, I'll just add that it's been a lot of fun so far, and we look forward to getting you a lot more interviews from people from the conference.
Yes. So, bye for now.
All right. Goodbye. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Stutter Talk. This is Chris Constantino. I am with Inika Sampson. We are at the International Fluency Association World Congress in Lisbon, Portugal. And the IFA can be found at theifa.org. Stutter Talk can be found at stuttertalk.com. Inika is a speech-language pathologist from Stockholm, and she had a very interesting talk about or poster about gender and stuttering, and she's going to tell us a little bit about her work right now. Inika, can you introduce us to your topic?
Yes, hello, I can. I have been interested in the topic stuttering and gender for some time, as I think that the ratio for stuttering among adult people, which is supposedly 4 to 6 men on 1 woman, could be questioned, because I have seen no research on what point in time does this sort of dramatic shift occur, that girls just grow out of stuttering.
Mm-hmm.
As the ratio when they're small, when they start stuttering, the onset of stuttering is fairly balanced. So I thought I would do a follow-up study of children that were diagnosed with stuttering when they were small. And to see now, some years later, 9 years later, what had happened? How was the recovery rate, and what was the sex ratio? So I met, out of 236 children, I saw 24 only, which was a small group. Mm-hmm. And it was a group mixed with the children who did not stutter anymore and children who stuttered still. So it was 50-50, more or less, in this little group. And the sex ratio for those children who still stuttered was also almost 50-50. So the sex ratio was not as supposed to be very much many more boys.
Yes.
In the follow-up, but on the other hand, they were only 24 out of 236. So I couldn't draw any big conclusions on that. So what I did, I went back to the 236 people again, minus the 24 that I already met.
Yes.
And I sent them a letter again, and I asked if they could tell me, just text me a message, does your child still stutter? And if the child also could text me a message, if he or she still stuttered. And then I got 125 parents answered this, and 53 children answered. And when I looked at the figures, the parents, they thought to a greater extent that their child had stopped stuttering than if you asked the children if they stopped stuttering. So the children thought, quite higher number of the children still thought that they were stuttering. And when looking at the sex ratio, a lot more girls were stuttering in the children's group, mm-hmm. as they said, compared to the parents' group. So there is still some confusion, I would say. Yeah. I cannot say anything definite about this, but some confusion of what is recovery.
Yeah, and I think you're sort of challenging the idea that who gets to decide what this ratio is? Are we doing it based on a listener perspective or based on the person who stutters perspective? And I think most studies of childhood stuttering are from a listener perspective. And when you ask the children, like you've done, the ratio seems to be a lot more even.
Yes, right? It does. And that's important to continue to do research on, because there is a risk that we miss out girls growing up being women. Because if we constantly talk about this is stuttering is a sort of male thing, mm-hmm. well, then maybe this will just create false information, and yeah. you will sort of think that you're the only woman in the world who stutters because this is a male thing. And something else that is important to think about and to try to analyze is if being a girl in the society is connected to not talking very much, then you can just easily hide just stammering or stuttering with just talking less, and yeah. you will pass as a person who recovered.
Mm-hmm.
And this, so we internalize the problem for girls. There's a risk that you internalize it.
Yeah, and I think that's what I found most interesting about your poster was that it sort of brings up this idea of how do males and females exist differently in our society? What is acceptable behavior for a female that might seem a little bit more suspicious for a male speaker? And you bring up the point that, you know, your social norms are different.
Yes.
And that certain things that might be maybe normal for a female, such as not talking as much, could contribute to passing. Whereas if a male speaker would not be talking as much, that might, you know, raise some eyebrows. And we have this notion of stuttering as a male disorder, so we might be underserving the female population.
Yeah. I was also quite surprised to see that for the group that I met, 24 children, when I asked the children, do you still stutter? Well, some said yes, some said no. Well, the agreement with the parents was not 100%. So the parents said, in some cases, the parents said, no, my child does not stutter anymore, while the child would say, yes, I stutter.
Mm-hmm.
Or vice versa, that the parent would say, yes, he or she still stutters, but the child would say, no, I don't stutter. And that's also, it's a little confusing, or what we should count as recovery again. Yeah. Because someone might say, well, I recovered from stuttering, but as a listener, you can still hear stuttering. So what do we do then? I mean, what do we judge?
Yeah. And you brought up the point that a lot of parents will say that the child has recovered, and the child will say that I still stutter. And I can't help but think about how in our prevalence data, we often use the quote that 1% of the population stutters.
Yeah.
And I've said this before, but if 1% of the population stutters, you would expect to hear it much more often than you do hear it. So the idea that a lot of people who stutter are probably passing as fluent, and your data seems to bring up this same issue that parents think their kids don't stutter anymore. And I'm not saying unequivocally that they do still stutter, but your data sort of questions how well parents can tell whether their kids are still stuttering. And that's interesting.
Yeah. And I think the speech language pathologist also, if we're not digging in deeper into this gender issue, we tend to measure stuttering from what we can say then male criteria, which is like overt behavior, percent stuttered syllables or stuttering like disfluences, things that we hear or see, but we are not digging deeper into what other symptoms might there be and are they related to gender.
Yeah.
So when we assess, we have to ask more, we have to be more profound and more getting into the person's, to be more gender aware of gender at least.
Yeah. Absolutely. And we were talking about earlier how even though the gender difference is well noted in the literature, nobody seems to have taken that into account in their studies, right? Nobody seems to be asking questions about, you know, why this might be a difference.
No.
Or how this difference might interact with how society looks at gender norms and that kind
of thing.
I think there's a lot of good potential research that your work could hopefully lead to in the future.
Yeah, me too. I'm going to continue on this topic for sure.
Do you have any ideas in the works right now?
I thought I would do a survey, a sort of web survey with teenagers broadly, and ask them in general, how do you feel about, you know, attitude towards communication? And maybe if they have a history of stuttering, and see if you can detect gender differences, or if you can detect a higher ratio, a higher... I'm not really sure how I would do this study, but, you know, try to... What I want to capture are those people who are not seeing a clinician.
Yeah, we talked about this earlier too, is, and I think, how do you get those people?
Yeah.
Like, how do you contact those people? Because you want... It's almost like you want people who are not currently diagnosed, right?
Yeah, sure. So if you would detect that people, young people, teenagers, they have, let's say, fear of speaking in the classroom, which is not unusual. But if they also have a history of stuttering, maybe it's, you know, that's the reason why they feel it's hard to speak in the classroom. And if you then find girls more often than boys, something like that.
Yeah, cool. Well, I'm really excited about your work, and I'm looking forward to seeing what happens in the future. Thank you for talking with me.
Thank you.